WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are going to get the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery back out onto the road. I promise when we get unmasked, I'm going to be at the Super Bowl 2 weeks from now. This is a guy that's covered a couple of Super Bowls we have here. He is an eternal favorite guest of our Baltimore County Executive, Don Moeller, he's got a new book out. And the last time he was on, we extended longer on some topics of the book. Don has the book. Don, tell everybody who our guest is, your favorite all-time guest.
Oh, one of my favorites, Washington Post, Golf Channel, you name it, Sports Illustrated. John Feinstein, author of 45 books. And when I read a book,
is that your handwriting? What is that?
Oh, I was going to say, he always makes fun of me, John. I mean, there are notes and page notes all through the front of the book so that I can go.
Well, I hope you're not like me because I can't read my own handwriting.
Well, it's almost that bad. You know, that's why I put a page number, John, so that when I look and I say, well, it must have been important because I put it with a page number and I'll have to go back and read that page. Listen, welcome. Incredible book, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, and we will get into it. I will tell you that as a granddad, one of the things that made me feel so good, all of my grandsons are sports nuts, and one of them is 15, another one is 12. And I said to both of them, I said, you know what, you guys, it's important to keep reading, and I think you'd really enjoy this. And I said, go ahead, and they do it all through Kindle, of course. I said, get this book on your Kindle. And a few days later, for my 15-year-old to say, hey, Pop, you know that Feinstein book? That's really a good book. And I thought, there it is. There's your review.
Yeah, I'll take it.
John, start, if you will. We're not going – I'm going to tell our listeners right away, we're not going to get through the entire book. It was like one of those things, you have 10 hours, you got to figure out how to get it in 40 minutes. So we're going to give you a snippet, and hopefully if you're out there, you run to your bookstore, you go to wherever your online books, whatever you want to do, local bookstore online, and get this, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee. When we spoke to you a couple of months ago, John, you had talked about the difficulty of getting this book to print in the sense that a lot of people didn't want you to do it.
Right.
Your publisher wasn't crazy about the idea, and you said, to hell with it. This is an important book. I'm going to write it anyway. Now that you've written it, now that it's out, now that people are reading you, was their concern warranted?
I don't think so, based on the reviews, Don. I'm not sure I've ever had a book that's gotten better reviews than this one. Season on the Brink got great reviews because people were surprised by the access that I got to Bob Knight. My Army Navy book, as you guys know, got great reviews, but this one has been really nothing short of raves. The Washington Post gave it a great review a couple weeks ago. Sporting News has given it a great review. Friends of mine like Jay Billis and Mike Wilbon have tweeted about how both have said they think this is my best book. And I'm not sure if it's my best because it's really hard to judge your own books. But I think it is my most important, as I said to you guys earlier, because of the subject.
Well, it's a page turner.
I think that has a lot to do with the guys I talked to and what they were willing to tell me about their lives and their opinions. And, you know, when guys like Mike Tomlin and Tony Dungy and John Thompson, who I was able to talk to before he got sick in 2020, when they're willing to open up, it's hard to go wrong, really. And it wasn't just black guys. I Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, Mike Krzyzewski were all very outspoken on this issue and how important this issue is. And the list, as you know, because you've read the book, is a long one. I interviewed probably about 100 guys. And I've always thought, Don, that my strength is reporting. That's what I think I do best. I think I know who to talk to. I think I know what is a story. And I think hope that's reflected in this book. Certainly, again, based on the reviews, it is.
John, you've written 45 books, right? And
yes,
I've written two, and I know the minute they came to me and the first sheet of paper where I'm like, these are chapters, this is when you begin a book, what made you write this book? And at what point? Because the knee, when you talk about the knee in my lifetime, it's affected my life greatly because of my access with the Ravens. And there are very few white people in suburbs that I talk to around here and I say, why don't you go to the game anymore? Well, they took the knee on foreign soil. And that's where it begins for people that had purple flamingos on their lawn. Right. That's changed the organization here over the last 5 years from that moment in Wembley. And that's just as a Raven. That has nothing to do with Kaepernick or what does, but Trump, all of that. But the seeding of this for you to say, all right, I'm going to do a book and this is going to be the book and this is the book I'm going to do.
Well, it's a good question, Esther. And again, what you're describing is certainly not unique to Baltimore. I mean, there are lots and lots of white football fans and white people out there who, because they have not lived it, don't understand what it's like to be a black person in this country. Now, I'm not going to claim I do because I'm white and I've never been pulled over by a cop for DWB driving while black. When I get pulled over, it's usually because I deserve to get pulled over. And there are all sorts of other issues that black people face every day of their lives that a lot of white people not only don't face, but don't want to discuss, don't want to have brought up to them. And I get that. That was one of the points of the book was, look, folks, you're not living this. Here are people who have lived it or who have been around it, as Kerr, Krzyzewski, Popovich, me, and do have an understanding of it. When I was in college, I wrote a story once about a Duke freshman quarterback who came in and saved a game named Mike Dunn. And the editor, I was stringing for the Durham Morning Herald, inserted black Duke freshman quarterback Mike Dunn. I grew up in New York. I never thought about black, white, Hispanic. I played ball all the time with blacks, with whites, with Hispanics, and never gave it a thought. But now I'm in North Carolina. And when I told Doug Williams this story, because Doug wrote the foreword for the book and we've been friends for years, he laughed at me and he said, boy, were you naive? Of course they put it in. It was the 1970s. How many black quarterbacks were there at the Division I college level? Not to mention virtually none.
And by the way, it had your byline on it, right?
Yes,
so it
did.
Said under by John Feinstein, black, like you
it
called him a black.
And that was very upsetting to me.
Boy, I mean, every word mattered to me when I was a kid at the newspaper, when they put a word in or took a word out. Hey, that's got my name on the top. My dad's going
to
read that.
That's right. You know? I say that to editors all the time. I totally different subject, but I wrote a piece years ago about Fairleigh Dickinson in Brooklyn, which is one of four Division I NCAA teams that has never made the NCAA tournament. I wrote pieces about all the teams that hadn't. And I went and spent time with the coaches. And I grew up in New York, as you know. And I described the fact that the guy who was coaching Fairleigh Dickinson at the time had been an assistant at St. John's. And when he took the job at Fairleigh Dickinson, instead of going north on the BQE to get to his job, he went south on the BQE to get to his job. Someone, without talking to me, changed the BQE to a subway. And I had a guy come up to me. I was doing a talk in Florida, and a guy came up to me. He said, didn't you grow up in New York? And I said, yes. And he said, well, then you got to know that the BQE is a highway, not a subway. And I said, of course I know that. And he said, well, the story you had in the paper yesterday said it's a subway. And I called and talked to my editor, the basketball editor at the time. And I said, who is this copy editor who did this? And I want him to die.
Who is this monster?
Yeah. And the guy wouldn't even tell me his name, you know, and because I think he was afraid I might kill him. But your point is right, Nestor. My name was on the piece, not his. So he had a responsibility, if he was going to make a change like that, to talk to me. Hey, John, isn't the BQE a subway? No, Joe, the BQE is a highway. I grew up in New York. So your point is well taken. And I was upset at the time about especially inserting something like that. You know, it's not like they changed freshman to sophomore. They added the word black. But again, as Doug Williams said, back then it was relevant. Dunn was Duke's first black freshman quarterback. Very good player, by the way. And so I covering sports and being around a lot of black people and a lot of white people, and seeing some of the issues that come up and seeing some of the numbers that we see in terms of hiring for coaches and general managers in all sports. It was in the back of my mind that this was an issue. And then, as you said, Nestor, the anthem protests came about in 2017. And you were in the stadium there. I saw every week because I was doing my quarterback book. So I was in an NFL stadium every week. Same thing. Black players kneeling, white fans booing. 90% of those people who booed were white, or maybe even 100, and almost 100% of the players kneeling were black. And they were saying things like you just brought up, like, how dare you kneel for the national anthem? You're not an American. Donald Trump said it. Kick them out of the country. The fact is, they were kneeling because they wanted our country to be better than it is. And that's why I know a lot of guys who were in the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. And every one of them, not most of them, every one of them understood why those guys were kneeling. So when I saw that, that's when I went to see John Thompson, who had become kind of a mentor of mine after he retired, even though he fought like cats when he was coaching. And I said, I want to do a book on race and sports. And he looked at me and said, you might as well try to explain the Holy Trinity. And then he pointed at me and said, which is why you have to do it. And from that point forward, I was determined to do it, even though, as Don mentioned, not just my publisher at the time, Doubleday, five publishers rejected this book. And my agent didn't want me to do it. And I reminded a number of people now that the book has done well, five publishers rejected Season on the Brink too. And it did okay.
Well, John, for me in that period of time, if I go back to the Wembley thing and the Ravens, you know, got their ass kicked over there, it kind of changed everything, certainly changed everything in their club level and the military components at Northrop Grumman that held tickets and suites and whatnot for Bisciotti, who was dabbling with Colin Kaepernick before the Pig Sox came about.
Hurt.
I was at that press conference. I was there the day Goodell was there at the preseason game. I asked Goodell, are you blackballing Colin Kaepernick? And he, my God, bristle at me. But here's the thing about the Wembley thing that I think's fascinating. In the aftermath of that, I took CJ Mosley down to Costas, and he and I sat in Costas alone. Number one draft, no one came. No one came, asked for his autograph. We sat in the corner doing the show. It's like it didn't exist. It was vicious in that way, but it was also on media day on Wednesday and Thursday and after the game, hey, guy, why'd you take a knee? Well, he's unavailable. You know, the Ravens PRs made him unavailable. And that's going on around the league. Nobody wanted anybody to talk about it. The retired players, I know Anquan Boldin was involved a little bit, and some players that were on the other end that were talking about it a little bit. But it was something where the knee would happen, and then after the game, it's like it didn't happen. I go to talk to Joe Flacco, and Wembley said, I didn't really see what happened. I didn't see what happened. Then the gaslighting begins. Then it's, oh, you didn't see the 15 guys taking. You just have nothing to say about it, so that's, I didn't see it. And that's what happened that year, as nobody in Owings Mills wanted to talk about it. Nobody in any front office wanted to talk about it anywhere. And that probably is the same reason five publishers didn't want you talking about it.
Well, it continues, right. John. Does right. it? I'm sorry. Does it not on. Continue? I don't want you to jump into what Nestor said, because one of my questions was, I found it curious. There are two people, at least two, that wouldn't be interviewed for your book, and coming at it from two different perspectives. One is Kareem, and we'll talk about why Kareem, because I think he would have been a wonderful addition, as I'm sure you do, to the book. And Roger Goodell, and I was just fascinated that Roger Goodell would not want to be on the record with you for this book. What is your take? And I know you reached out multiple times.
I did. Yeah. Well, two very different reasons. I actually knew Kareem because I did interview him for my book on Kermit Washington and Rudy Tomjanovich, The Punch. And he was great because, as you know, he's a very bright, thoughtful guy.
Right.
But the contact I had who had put me in touch with Kareem back then, this is 2003, was no longer in touch with Kareem. So I had to go through his gatekeeper. This woman who, you know, if you want to talk to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you got to get in touch with this woman, which I did. And I told her that I had interviewed Kareem in the past, and she turned me down within 5 minutes. No, Kareem doesn't have time. He's too busy. Well, what that means in English is, you know, if you're not paying, we're not interested. I mean, clearly she's got some kind of percentage deal with him on when he gets paid. So I wrote her back and I said, would you please just give this note to Kareem? And if he says no after he reads it, that's fine. And in the email I wrote, you know, Kareem, you may remember, I interviewed you. He actually called me after the book came out and thanked me for quoting him so accurately and depicting the events as accurately as I did. That doesn't happen very often. He did it. And so I reminded him of all that. And said, told him what I was doing and why I wanted to talk to him. Again, within 5 minutes, she writes back, "Kareem's never heard of you." Well, that was a lie.
Okay? Yeah, that he's pretty well read, John.
And I even tried to get the NBA to go around her. And the NBA said they couldn't get around her to him. So that's what happened with Kareem. Goodell was different. And I think because I never had any harsh words with Goodell. I'd interviewed him in the past. I even did a magazine piece on him once and sat in his office for about an hour. And so I tried to go through Brian McCarthy, who you guys probably know is his number one PR guy, explained what I was doing, why I wanted to talk to him, that I had talked to all the other commissioners. And the answer came back, no, Roger's too busy. Again, that's BS. You're only busy when you don't want to talk. And I asked Mike Tomlin and I asked Tony Dungy, two guys who I have worlds of respect for. Why do you think Goodell won't talk to me? Your same question, Don. They both said the same thing. They said he's embarrassed. He knows that the numbers are terrible. And by the way, since then, we've gone from three black coaches to one.
Right.
We'll see with the openings, the first hiring in this round, Denver, white guy. But
they did hire two African-Americans to run organizations within about an hour of each other earlier this week. And there's nothing more orchestrated. It felt orchestrated to me. It always does. But it feels like end racism on the back of helmets and like all of that. It feels like it's
well, it's like a friend of mine said to me the other day, well, but there's no more racism in the NFL. They have on the fields. It says end racism. So it must be over, right?
That's all done.
But that's what Don, to answer your question. And I think, again, I don't think Goodell's a bad guy necessarily, but he's paid $44 million a year to try to make the owners look good. And there's no way to deal with this issue and make the owners look good. And one other point, Nestor, remember Goodell in 2020 admitted that Kaepernick was blackballed. And this is after we spent the whole 2017 season with most of the NFL media writing stories, quoting anonymous front office executives saying, oh, he's not been blackballed. He just can't play anymore. He was a starter in San Francisco the year before he left there. He started the last 11 games of the season. Now, was he as good as he was when he took them to the Super Bowl? Probably not, but he was 29 years old. Remember, when the Ravens talked to him in July after Flacco got hurt and didn't sign him, they signed a guy out of the Arena Football League, for crying out loud. You tell me that guy was a better quarterback than Colin Kaepernick? Of course he was blackballed.
No, there. And again, for those of you listening, we're John Feinstein, Washington Post, 45 books, latest book, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, incredible page turner. Don't miss it. You mentioned, as I said, there's so many things I'd like to chat about. You talked about John Thompson, who's a key part of this book. There are many, many more that I'm going to mention, but there are three pieces of your Thompson recollections and interviews that I'd like you to touch on. And in any order, John, one, I want you to talk about former nun Mary Fenlon, because I found her character fascinating. People have probably never heard of Mary Fenlon. And as someone who grew up in Catholic schools, I think I knew a lot of Mary Fenlons in my affection for the nuns. I want you to talk about John holding court. I think the line you used in the book at the NCAA tournament, there were always late night meetings, but the meetings didn't start, I think you said, until Big John arrived. I think right. That's the way you wrote it. And then I want you to talk about John Feinstein suggesting to John Thompson that we step outside. So those three moments.
Well, let's start with that.
Nestory to me.
Well, let's start with that because it just proves that I'm not very bright. And this was 1984. It was the year they won the national championship. And I was doing a long profile on Patrick Ewing and had actually been granted an audience with Ewing, which was very rare. And after I talked to him, I had a couple follow-up questions. So I circled back to John. I prefer to talk to him in person because when he got going, he was so good. Also, if you called him, he would call you back at 2 o'clock in the morning. And you know, I like to sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I went to a game, they won, and John and Mary always came out of the locker room together. They were frickin' frack. And they'd been together since John was a high school coach at St. Anthony's here in in D.C. That's how they met. Mary was teaching there at the time. And so they come walking out of the locker room to go to the interview room. And I was waiting and I said, "Hey, John, when you get done in the interview room, can I grab you for a couple minutes for some follow-ups on Ewing?" And before John could answer, Mary said, "He doesn't have time to talk to you." And I said, "You know, Mary, it's funny. I thought I was talking to John. I didn't realize I was talking to you." And John reared up to his full height, which, as you know, was 6'10". And he said, "Let me tell you something," and used his favorite word. First half of it, his mother. "If you talking to me, you talking to Mary. If you talking to Mary, you talking to me. If you messing with Mary, you messing with me. You want to mess with me, mother blank?" And I looked at him and I said, "You know what, John, let's go outside." Because if what Will Jones told me — Will Jones was the UDC coach who had played against John in high school — if what Will Jones told me about you, which was that John was a very soft player, and that was the irony of his teams being so tough. If what Will Jones told me about you I'll kick your butt. If not, you'll kick my butt. And John started laughing, thank God. And he put his arm around me and he said, "You know something, mother blank, I don't like you. I don't like you one bit, but I respect your ass because you're blanking crazy." So he talked to me. So I was lucky to survive that, because if we'd gone outside, I'm pretty damn sure it wouldn't have gone well for me. Mary Fenlon, as I said, she had been a nun. She went with John to Georgetown, and she was the academic advisor for all his players who got them into classes, made them go to class. Because most of John's players who graduated, and there were questions about whether they were academically qualified, especially Ewing. But Ewing graduated in 4 years. Most of his players graduated in 4 years. John, in his autobiography, gave a lot of the credit to that to Mary. I give a lot of the credit to that to John because they were — I don't care what anybody says — they were scared of John. Not physically scared.
If she could have failed out Sleepy Floyd, maybe we could have beat them back in the tournament back in the day, right?
Well, Sleepy Floyd was actually a very good student.
He was a pretty good basketball player, as I remember. He was
a pretty damn good basketball player, too. And what was the third thing you asked me about?
Oh, the meeting doesn't start until Big John arrives.
John used to hold court for many years in the lobby of the coaches' hotel at the Final Four. I mean, we writers would always put together an all lobby team of coaches who were there the most. And John was the leader of the all lobby team, which is great, because I used to argue with him late into the night. It was fantastic because he was smarter than me, so I would learn from him. But in the late 80s, John, George Raveling, who was the first D1 coach at a Power Five school, at Washington State, was an assistant under Lefty at Maryland once upon a time. John Chaney and Nolan Richardson, the guys who were kind of the pioneers of great black college basketball coaches, they put together informally a late night meeting and invited other black coaches and black journalists to that meeting. I was never invited for obvious reasons. I'm not black. But guys who were invited to the meeting, like Kevin Blackstone, Mike Wilbon, and others, said, "Nothing started till Big John walked in the room. He was the king. And once he was there and sat down, they'd start talking about God knows what until the wee hours of the morning." I wish I had been in those meetings.
It's fascinating. There are so many insights. And as we, at some point, we're going to ask you big takeaways, because I was trying to think, to understand this book, I think you have to go to 10,000 feet. But there are also times where you come down into the weeds. And one of the things, again, since I'm an old guy, I was 18 years old at the time of John Carlos and Tommy Smith. And I remember it well. I'm going to ask you to walk us through again for your listeners, because there are a couple things with that, John. How it ended up with one glove on each player. I mean, I read that and I thought, well, this is a — what is Nestor called? What's your word? Oh, serendipity, Nestor. That's your word. Serendipity. I thought, ends up with one glove on each hand. That was kind of amazing. And then a story, I don't know how, I never read it, about the Australian who won the silver, Peter Norman, and what he did. I mean, this part of the book, it's a jaw dropper to me, John.
Yeah, it's funny. I was lucky that I was able to get both Tommy Smith and John Carlos to talk to me, because I didn't know either one of them. because they were long retired before I became a sports writer.
Our mutual pal David Steele wrote a long book on them. Yep.
Yeah. And I was able to, it was actually Marlon Briscoe, who was the first quarterback, black quarterback, to play professionally with the Broncos in the AFL in 1968. It was interesting. Ozzie Newsome got me to James Harris. James Harris got me to Marlon Briscoe. Marlon Briscoe got me to John Carlos because they'd been friends. And Tommy Smith, I got to through his wife, who sort of controls his life. She had no clue who I was when I first called, but eventually she Googled me, and fortunately Tommy was willing to talk to me. But the Peter Norman angle, which I think a lot of people don't know about.
Oh, it was great.
Peter Norman won the silver medal that night. He's from Australia, as you said, Don. And John and Tommy felt that they should let him know what was going to happen on the medal stand before it happened. And John, they were both supposed to wear two gloves. John forgot to bring his. So Tommy gave him the left glove. He took the right. He said, I took the right because I'm right-handed. And so they each, as you've seen the iconic photo of Tommy with his right arm up in the air and John with his left arm up in the air. John and Tommy were part of a group that had considered boycotting the Olympics because of all that was going on with civil rights in our country back then, had decided not to, had decided the better way to speak out was this way, by competing and by winning. And they had a button. They had buttons that they were wearing for the organization. And Peter Norman said, if you give me one of those buttons, I'll wear it on the medal stand to show my support for you. Well, they didn't have an extra button. So Peter Norman went and found a member of the U.S. crew team who did have a button. He gave him the button. He was almost thrown off the crew team because he had done that. That's the way the U.S. Olympic Committee was. And he wore the button on the medal stand. And as a result, he probably was made more of a pariah in Australia for doing that than Tommy Smith and John Carlos were back in this country, because they did have some supporters, just as Colin Kaepernick had some supporters almost 50 years later. But how bad was it? Well, first of all, Carlos Smith and Peter Norman were friends for life. In fact, Peter flew up to San Jose State to be there when they unveiled a statue of John and Tommy in 2004, I want to say. And the statue is the two of them. The silver medal podium is empty because Peter Norman said, leave it empty so people can stand there and know what it felt like, which I thought was incredibly cool. He died of a heart attack in 2006. John and Tommy both flew to Australia to be eulogists and pallbearers. And Tommy told me that was the heaviest coffin I ever carried, because they had so much respect for Peter. And how bad was it? Peter Norman was not selected for the 1972 Olympic team, even though he was then and still is today the Australian record holder in the 200. And in 2012, 6 years after he died, the Australian Parliament issued an apology to his family for the way he had been treated in Australia. So you're right, Don. That's a remarkable part.
For not being a racist, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, John.
For not being, yes, exactly right, 100%.
Again, what I hope our listeners are taking from these tidbits, this is 300 and some pages. And as Nestor always kids me, I take note after note. I had to keep going because I ran out of pages to take notes on, because every page is filled with this. Now, in this same incident, and Nestor, I don't know if you remember this. I'm going to ask John to walk us through it. I had to read the Brett Musburger part of this twice.
Right.
I'm scratching my head. I'm going, this is the iconic Brett Musburger. Question is, I want you to tell folks what he wrote in the wake of this protest. And then I want you to proselytize a little bit here. If people don't think racism and systemic racism is real, the fact that he could survive what he wrote
and become an icon, as you said,
and become an icon is remarkable. So walk us through the Musburger piece, because Nestor, I'll be curious if you did know this.
Musburger was a very young columnist for the Chicago American at the time, covering the Olympics in 68. And after the protest, he wrote a column attacking Smith and Carlos for what they did. And among other things, wrote that they looked like black-skinned stormtroopers standing on the metal stand. And how dare they conduct a protest when they were in Mexico City, quote, on the USOC's dime. You think the USOC sent them down there as an act of charity? Or because they were there to win medals for the USOC and for the United States? And Musburger has never publicly apologized. He's been urged to by people publicly and privately. And I've known Musburger for years. I reached out to him while researching the book. And I said, you know, I've talked to Smith. I've talked to Carlos. I'd like to hear your, you know, side of the story. And Brent texted me back a photo of him with Tommy Smith with no explanation and said something about how much he respected Tommy Smith's mother. So I wrote him back again. And I said, well, now I really want to talk to you. Since you met with Tommy Smith.
How hard is it to be a 75-year-old man to say I was wrong? Is it that? Is it that tough?
He's 82, by the way, Nestor.
Okay.
And he said, so he wrote me back. He said, you know, hearing from you makes me think that I should write my own book. Do you know anybody who'd be interested in doing it? And I said, no, but I still want to talk to you for this book. Never heard back from him. I went back to Tommy Smith and I said, what was that photo about? Well, Tommy Smith is good friends with Mark Davis from his days in Oakland because Tommy went to and taught at San Jose State. And Mark Davis asked him to come to dinner with Musburger in Las Vegas, which is where Musburger lives when after he moved the team. And Tommy Smith said, okay. And I said, what happened? Did he apologize? He said, no, he didn't apologize. He said, I had to write the column that way because that's what my editors wanted. And he said, then Musburger started to cry and came over and hugged him and never said, I'm sorry. And I said, what did you think of that? He said, I guess I'll take that as the apology. It's as close as I'm going to get. But you're right, Nestor. I mean, God knows we've all made mistakes in our life. I mean, how many times a day do I apologize to my wife for crying out loud?
Well, when you say things on the radio or you write things as you've been writing for 45 years, time changes how you feel about some things or some issues. Just that's part of,
you know, you're wrong right away. You know, I mean, there. The other day at Navy, I was at the Army-Navy basketball game, and I had taken my mask down because it's uncomfortable. I mean, it's a fact of life, but I had taken it down. Nobody was sitting that close to me. It was during the game, and a security guard came up behind me and said, you need to put your mask on. And he didn't do it politely. He should have said, you know, sir, do me a favor, put your mask on. But he was right, and I got mad at him, and I started yelling, you know, what are you doing? I put the mask on. And then a minute later, I said, I was wrong. This guy's just doing his job. So I turned around and I went to him. I apologized. I said, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have yelled at you. Of course you were doing your job. And he said, no worries. Don't worry about it. But if I hadn't apologized, I would have walked out of that arena feeling badly about myself. Still didn't feel that great since I lost my temper. But we all make mistakes. We all say things we don't want to say. And now, Musburger wrote it. And maybe he was under pressure from his editor.
And it never, John, my take.
The words, I'm sorry, should have come out of his mouth.
But that was what was expected of him in 1968 to keep his job, though. And then he's probably not.
Make that part of the explanation, but then say, I'm sorry.
See, that's my takeaway. And again, I was trying to put together the takeaways from the book so that we can learn from it. And I thought, just an example of the systemic racism that's been there for, and you talk about the talk, and you didn't interview, I don't think, one African American player or coach from this book who has children who didn't vividly describe the talk, right, John?
Right. Absolutely right.
And again, maybe for our listeners who's saying, what the hell's Don talking about, the talk? Maybe. Yeah. Because there were two things that jumped out at me, the talk and the DWB, the driving DWB, while black. Yeah. I don't think you interviewed one person that couldn't talk at length about each one, right?
Not one. And the unique one, of course, was Cullen Jones, the Olympic swimmer, who was one stop for WDWB, walking dog while black.
Right.
Because a cop did a U-turn, came back to him when he was walking his dog and started demanding to know where he got the dog, as if he had stolen it. And that's the first question guys say that, you know, they get pulled over, and most of these guys are successful, so they're driving a nice car. First question, where'd you get this car? As opposed to Ken Norman, who Doc Rivers told me when he was playing for the Clippers, stopped for gas on his way to LA Sports Arena in South Central LA. And the next thing he knew, he was across the hood of the car being handcuffed because the cops pulled up and just assumed he'd stolen the car. And this is the kind of thing I'm saying that none of us can truly understand because we've never experienced it. And the talk is black fathers and mothers sitting their kids down, particularly boys, and saying, this is going to happen to you. And when it does, you can't get angry. You can't give the cop any lip. You got to put your hands on the dashboard, say, yes, sir, no, sir. May I reach in the glove compartment for my registration? And Mike Tomlin told me when he sat his two sons, his two sons down, when they were getting ready to get their driver's license, they're 2 years apart. His older son said to him, oh, come on, Dad, it's 2017. We live in a nice neighborhood. This isn't going to happen to us.
And I know his kids, so it's even this is even funnier for me.
And three times in the first year, he was stopped for DWB in a car that his dad owned.
In Pittsburgh.
In the neighborhood.
Right.
In the neighborhood where they lived. And people know where Mike Tomlin lives in Pittsburgh, for crying out loud, right? People know where John Harbaugh lives in Baltimore. And do you think one of John Harbaugh's kids has ever been stopped for that? No, of course not.
Well, that was my – that's where it becomes very personal, having, you know, raised two children, having grandchildren who are now about to become teenagers. I'll have many talks with my 15-year-old as he gets ready to drive right. in a year about not being a knucklehead, you know, put seatbelt on, don't text and drive. But I won't be saying – I won't be having the talk about how to behave.
Correct.
And it still goes on. John, one of my – I intuited this, so I need you to walk me through because you spent time with these guys. What I was struck by was I didn't get a lot of anger about this from the guys you interviewed as much as a resignation, the sort of Doc Rivers-y.
Back to life.
We love the country so much. Why won't it love us back? Is that what came across from all your interviews? Because that's what I took away.
Yeah, I think they've all had angry moments for good reason. But you're right. I mean, we're talking about guys who have dealt with all of this for years and years, and who I know resent it and wish it weren't so, but understand that it is so, and yeah. Understand that one of the things that helped me with this book, Don, was that so many of these guys were grateful to me for wanting to write the book, for wanting to bring up these issues, for wanting to talk to them about these issues. And, you know, there, Kenny Williams, the vice president, executive vice president of the White Sox, who's been the head of their organization basically since he was named general manager in 2001, told me after the press conference where he was named GM, he drove home, and the first thing he heard was a Chicago sports talk radio guy saying they only gave him the job because he's black. And he'd been running their minor league system, which was the best in baseball, for the last 4 years. So maybe there was a reason to give him the job besides he was black. And when he got home, spray painted on the side of his house were the words, the Chicago White Sox don't need an N-word, the word spelled out, as a general manager. Now, that didn't make him angry. I don't know what makes you angry.
Right.
But it's 20 years later. So he was able to tell me the story in a very calm voice. I think it made me angrier at this point than it made him.
Yeah, it made me. But yes, the book made me sad.
Yep.
And
that's the right.
And I guess my emotion was sad. And, you know, I have an affection for Tiger. You've had a checkered relationship with Tiger.
Yes.
And you write about one of my favorite sports figures of all time for many reasons, Arthur Ashe. And I think I remember you saying it somewhere like this. We all know the Jordan famous line that Republicans buy shoes too, buy sneakers right. too. And I think you allude to the fact there's a wistful part of the book where you say it would have been nice had Tiger's mentor perhaps been Arthur Ashe as opposed to Michael. Am I capturing that correctly?
No, you are, because, and I wrote this years and years ago. And again, Tiger's the greatest player of all time, all due respect to Jack Nicklaus, but sometimes you have to separate the athlete from the person. And the person that I've dealt with since 1997 hasn't always been somebody who I've found particularly likable because of the way he's treated people, notably his wife and his children. But Arthur, I was close to Arthur. Arthur used to write columns for the Washington Post on occasion. So I got to know him that way. He was Davis Cup captain when I covered tennis. And in fact, I don't believe in blurbs for books, you know, where you go and you ask your friends, hey, can you say something great about this book before it comes out? Larry King, and when he was alive, and Bob Costas, I think, have their names on the back of about 1,000 books. I do blurbs when asked by a friend. When I'm asked by a stranger, I explain that I don't believe in blurbs. The only blurb I've ever had on a book was from Arthur. And I sent him my tennis book before it came out. And he called me and he said, would you like a blurb? It's Arthur. Of course I said, yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Arthur Ashe. Yes. Thank you. But Arthur was the first person I ever heard say that when you're black in this country, you have two jobs. One is your job and the other is to be black and deal with it every day. And Arthur died in 1993. What a terrible year that was. Arthur died. Jim Valvano died. And my mom died. So horrible. Yeah,
that's a bad year for
that was a bad year.
Arthur died at 49. Incredible, right?
Arthur was 49, right. Bad. He got a bad needle when he was in the hospital because of his heart issues and died of AIDS. But so that's 33 years ago now since Arthur said that to me. And now it's 29 years ago since Arthur died. And it's still true today. Ed Tapscott, who was the coach at American and was the first black CEO of an NBA team, said that to me right at the start of my research. And we were talking about the fact that no matter how much I might sympathize, I can't empathize because I haven't lived the life of a black person. And you know, you mentioned the word sad, Don, and I agree. The writing this was on many days very sad for me, but I kept saying to myself, this is important. People need to have a better understanding of this issue. And that's, people say, what do you hope they take away from the book? And that's what I hope. Whether you're on the right wing or the left wing or in the middle, I hope you'll understand that people who have lived this, not people like any of the three of us, and certainly not the people, Nestor, you were talking about, you know, who said, I'm not going to go to the games because guys are kneeling. Maybe they'll have a little better understanding of what these issues are.
Or hopefully their kids will. John Feinstein is our guest. Raise a fist, take a knee. 50 years of chronicling, really, through generations, through sports, through the American media, how this has been portrayed. And, John, I don't want to come in at the end like the 30-minute Mork and Mindy episode. So what have we learned here? But in this, I still deal with it every day that if I took phone calls here about Lamar Jackson's blackness or John Harbaugh's whiteness, or I remember this with Trent Dilfer and Tony Banks 20 years ago. And even as an Archie Bunker Dundalk guy, I was sort of taken aback taking these phone calls 20 years ago here on those subjects. The next 10 years, I guess for this generation that has taken a knee, has taken a stand, the league is now sort of cowered up in the NFL. But, you know, the NBA is doing business in China. They're looking the other way on the slaughter of the we can go through the responsibilities of the sports. Right. But they always think the responsibility will be, well, business will stop. Business will stop supporting this if it's perceived as racist in America. I thought that until I saw Trump get elected. I don't know where the future is, especially for black coaches trying to get jobs right now in the NFL, because it doesn't really feel like a whole lot's changed if I go to the owners' meetings in 6 weeks and see who's there making the decisions.
Well, let's go down the list of all the black owners in our four major sports.
We just did.
No, there's one, Michael Jordan.
Thank you.
Who will tell you Republicans buy sneakers. But that's the list. And there are no black owners in the NFL. The one so-called minority owner, Shad Khan, gave money to Trump. And that's why I think Tomlin and Dungy said Goodell is embarrassed because there's only so much he can do. He can't order an owner to hire someone. He can't say your next coach should be black. And of course, the excuse we hear is, well, are there enough candidates? There are candidates out the wazoo. Right.
Well, here's
now.
Where the gaslighting happens. They put a Rooney Rule in as a complete ruse. It's just a joke, right?
Yeah. Well, Nestor, there's a great
interview 11 times. I interviewed Eric Bieniemy for this book. So don't give me the he didn't interview well line, because he's a bright, articulate, funny, engaging guy. But he said to me, he didn't look the way these owners wanted him to look. And it's the same thing with other guys who are qualified, you know, who will get interviewed because of the Rooney Rule, but will they get a job? That's the question. And you made a good point about the next 10 years, Nestor. We've made progress. There's no question we've made progress. Although worth noting, back in the 60s and 70s, of course, all black quarterbacks were told to change positions. Warren Moon had to go play in Canada for 6 years because nobody would draft him coming out of the University of Washington. Doug Williams did get drafted because of Joe Gibbs. That's a story in itself. But he had watermelons thrown at him in Tampa when he was quarterbacking down there and sent to him in the mail. Throw this to your blank friends, your N-word friends. So, and here we are in 2022. 2018, what were people telling Lamar Jackson? Change positions. Be a running back. That's why, Nestor, you know this because you're there. Whenever Lamar has a particularly good game, what's the first thing he says? Not bad for a running back. And it took a black general manager to draft him in with the last pick of the first round. So have we made progress? You bet we made progress. I mean, five or six of the best quarterbacks in the NFL right now are black. And, you know, years ago, we didn't have five black quarterbacks in the NFL. One thing
– years ago, some struggling sports writer once referred to a Duke quarterback as black in content, right?
Right. Except I didn't.
Exactly.
We glossed over. Again, folks.
But again – The great question is, what are the next 10 years hold?
Right. Well, yeah. let's start with the over under, John, as we wrap up here on the 9 vacancies. We got 9 vacancies today. Right. What's the over under on African American hires of the 9 vacancies?
I'd say the over under is 2. And I don't know.
And you ain't betting the over.
I'm not sure I would bet the over.
Yeah. You think it's Leftwich?
I Leftwich should get hired. Flores never should have been fired.
Strange. One of the strange. It's up there with the Caldwell.
Neither
firing,
should Cully, right?
Cully, he got 1 year and he never got a snap from his best player. And he gets fired after one. How many times do coaches in any sport get fired after 1 year?
You use the Belichick example in the book and his record with Cleveland. He'd have been dead if he were an African-American coach, right? In terms
of
future.
He never would have gotten a second chance. He wouldn't have gotten 5 years, and he wouldn't have gotten a second chance.
And you can jump to baseball. Let's not just pick on football. The Willie Randolph part of the book is stunning. I mean just stunning.
Around, got him within one inning of the World Series in his second year. He had a winning record, and he got fired. And how many times do baseball managers get recycled? I mean, I love Buck Showalter. I think he's a very good manager. I'm glad the Mets hired him, but he's been hired 5 times.
Well, Nestor, there's a
record have gotten 5 jobs.
Nestor,
never got to the playoffs. Great guy. Never got swept. 5 jobs.
John has a tidbit in the book, Nestor. You always like to say the truth out loud. An owner actually said to Willie Randolph, it's one of my favorite parts, another favorite part of the book. Hey, Willie, we're going to hire a white guy, but will you talk to us just so we can say we interviewed a black guy? Now, I'm not making that up, right, John? That's in the book.
That's in the book, and that's what Willie told me. It was Colorado. They were going to hire Buddy Bell, and there is an unwritten rule in baseball that you're supposed to interview at least one minority candidate. It's not like the Roselle rule. It's not written in stone, but they call it the Selig rule. And so John O'Dowd was general manager in Colorado. He wanted Willie to fly out and interview, but he called him and he said, look, I still want to interview you, but we're hiring Buddy Bell. And so Willie said, well, you know, why should I fly out there? And he said, well, can you say that we interviewed you?
Said, yeah, I mean, there are parts of this book that you have to read more than once because you'll go, that really, really could not happen. Hey, John, before we
more than once.
It's a fabulous book. Before we let you out of here, we're asking everybody that's on this week 2 quick hit questions. NFL overtime rule should be changed or not changed?
I think they should be changed. I think both teams should get a chance to touch the ball. I mean, if a team scores in the top of the 10th inning, does the team not get to come to bat in the bottom of the 10th inning? You know, I don't mind it so much for regular season games, 10 minutes, because they're 10 minutes. But when you're playing for your season, you know, and again, people say, well, they should have played defense. You think they weren't trying?
Right.
You know, and the whole game was back and forth. The Bills scoring, the Chiefs scoring, what were there, 24 points in the last 2 minutes, whatever. And you say, well, they shouldn't have let them score in 13 seconds. Okay, but they did. That doesn't mean you should lose the game because you lost the coin. Yeah.
All right, so you're a yes on that. The other one we're asking folks this week is, where are you, which I think is a more complicated issue, on the Hall of Fame and the steroids guys?
It's funny you ask that because I'm about to write a column about it. I am adamant that and this a lot of people say this proves I'm old. I am old. If you cheated the sport, you can't be in the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame is a privilege that you get for making your sport better. Okay? Did Barry Bonds make the sport better by cheating and lying about it? Did Sammy Sosa make the sport better by cheating? Roger Clemens, Mark McGwire? And there are guys who say, well, David Ortiz tested positive once. Well, maybe he did. And I don't have a vote anymore because the Washington Post, we're not allowed to vote. I did vote for a few years. But if I know 100% you're a steroid cheat, you're not getting my vote because you damaged the sport. And the numbers are irrelevant. I have had colleagues of mine who I respect a lot say, well, you can't ignore the numbers. And I say, I'm not ignoring the numbers, but you can't ignore the cheating.
But John, everybody did it. Everybody was doing it.
Yeah, well, that's the other excuse. Right? You know, you go in front of a judge, you know, for speeding or something. Well, everybody speeds. Okay, but you got caught. Okay, so you're going to get fined. And imagine, you know, in golf, if Tiger Woods, the greatest player of all time, was caught cheating once. To this day, Vijay Singh was accused of cheating playing the Asian Tour in something like 1990. He's in the Hall of Fame. Okay, but there are players out there who will say, once a cheat, always a cheat. He got caught cheating once.
Absolutely.
Right? And these guys cheated for years and years. And they said, well, the pitchers they were faced, that Bonds faced, were probably on steroids too. Okay, fine. I'm not questioning his numbers or his ability. But there is a character clause in the Hall of Fame ballot for baseball. Not for football, but for baseball. And I'm invoking that character clause if I'm still voting. And no way am I voting for any of those guys.
Well, I can't wait to read the article. Folks, raise a fist. Take a knee. Get it on your nightstand. It's a page turner. Nestor, I knew this would be an outstanding session.
John, appreciate you, man. We'll see you over in Catonsville anytime down there at the new UMBC place. You can follow John Feinstein everywhere out on Twitter, as we do, even when he's being admonished by his children. And you can that'll be in our next edition. Go check out John's book. John, take care of yourself.
They want him to cry more. They just want him to cry more.
I'll leave you guys with this one thing. I'll leave you with this last thing. Jane, my daughter, who we're talking about, is in fifth grade. This is the first year she's gotten letter grades. Her first report card, because she's just like her mother, were 5 A's and 2 A-pluses. And I said, Jane, that's more A's than I got in my life. And she looked at me and said, why am I not surprised?
I am Nestor. We are WNST. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mueller and the great author John Feinstein, who sometimes is seen locally here courtside, we are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And we never stop talking, parenting, kids, and Baltimore Positive.